The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to this week's ExchangeWire MadTech Podcast. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by two very special guests. First, joining us in office, might I add, which is quite exciting, Jonathan Kitchen, who is Head of Sales EMEA at Dixerto. Jonathan, thanks so much for being here.
No problem at all. Good to be here.
Also joining us is ExchangeWire's very own COO, Lindsay Rowntree. Lindsay, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me here. I'm very excited, first of all, to have Jonathan on the podcast. Second of all, it's my first podcast with you, Mariam.
I know.
This is fun.
This is great. So we've got a bunch of exciting stories on the slate today. So I want to dive right in. First, coming from Forbes, is that Universal Music Group, the world's largest music company, has announced that it would be pulling its music from TikTok because its license agreement was expiring and renewal talks have broken down. So, Jonathan, going first to you here, who needs who more? Do you think there's winners and losers in this situation?
So, I mean, I think this story is really interesting. I actually went into a little bit of a rabbit hole when I looked into this.
Right, because, me too.
Yeah, the thing is, like with someone like Universal Music Group, most people know the artist, but actually, you know, it's Taylor Swift, it's Drake, but it's also Def Jam, it's Island Records, Rihanna, who is worth $1.4 billion. I told you I went down a rabbit hole. But and I think that's the thing. It's like they are such a enormous kind of music group.
Right.
And what's going, you know, kind of behind the scenes with a significant platform like TikTok is kind of exactly that. Who needs who more? I think one of the things when, again, sort of looking into this is what it actually means. So if you use TikTok, then, you know, you can add music to kind of your posts and all of that. So obviously now no artists from Universal Music Group will be available. But what it also means, because the whole thing's done through kind of Content ID and it's all very automated, is if I was to, I don't know, do a cover of a Lady Gaga song, and that could be picked up because technically it's the composers as well. So I think there's kind of quite far reaching for both users, you know, kind of when you're regularly using music in TikTok. So there's sort of a significant thing there. But again, in terms of those talks and them breaking down behind the scenes, because they are so significant, I do wonder, like, you know, you've seen it before with sort of slightly separate example, but like Taylor Swift coming off Spotify for a little while, you know, it's like, it, you know, how significant is that? But it certainly will, you know, kind of given the breadth of Universal, have an effect on kind of, you know, people putting up content. And also it does, I think, put a bit of a highlight on kind of this idea that none of us are really in control about it. So, you know, content being taken down. And if you're putting up content, and it might be where, you know, you're kind of a client for us might be using TikTok to put up content, we've got to be really sure that that content, they're able to use it if they're using music. So I think it kind of talks to that as well.
Right. Lindsay, what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, you're absolutely right about the content ownership. You might think you own that video, but there's only parts of it that you own, and that's probably your face and that's it. And any kind of any inkling, as you said, even if it was I'd love to hear your Lady Gaga cover, Jonathan, of course.
Are we gonna,
that was one that immediately came to mind. I'm not sure why.
But if you do that, I mean, obviously TikTok are trying their hardest to mute all the videos that contain any Universal music. But it's difficult because some of it is covers. Some of it is where the music's been sped up or slowed down or the pitch has been shifted. That could be for people trying to hack the system and can not get the music found out so they can still keep using it. Or it could just be because they wanted to. They're trying to work with ACR platforms, automatic content recognition platforms, to try and get them to be able to recognize pitch changes and everything else as well, which I think will be interesting. But I think that what I find most interesting is that, because I stumbled upon an open letter by Universal Music Group to TikTok, basically saying, you have bullied us and we're trying to fight for the rights of music. I'll read the opening paragraph. I won't read the whole thing because it's actually very long, but have a Google of it, because it's interesting, because there are things you don't think about, like when talking about, you know, Mariam, you asked who needs who more. Well, ultimately, as we discovered with Taylor Swift coming off Spotify, and I think there was a case of Warner Music Group coming off YouTube a while ago.
Yeah.
Ultimately, they come back on again, and it shows you the power of these platforms. And I think UMG, Universal, are trying to take some of that power away, and I wonder how successful they'll be. And that, I think, is a bit sad, really, because you know, our core mission is simple: to help our artists and songwriters attain their greatest creative and commercial potential. To achieve these goals, our teams employ their expertise and passion to strike deals with partners all around the world. Partners who take seriously their responsibility to fairly compensate our artists and songwriters and treat the user experience with respect. What they're saying is TikTok aren't doing that, and they've gone to TikTok with three key things. One is human rights, one is the caring and passion of the artists, and also one is the user experience and kind of the problem with AI being used to, we've got the recent kind of the porn video with Taylor Swift being a great example. That's not related to Universal, of course, but it is a good example of AI being used to kind of unfairly kind of use their likeness, their image, their voice in the case of songwriters. I think there's a lot to be said for that. And I think TikTok have basically just gone, nah, not interested. And they've actually then gone back to them and Universal have said that they have intimidated us and bullied us and come back to us with an offer that is actually less than the previous arrangement we had. And it makes you think, you know, I'd love for Universal to be able to stand their ground and be able to show TikTok, we don't need you. But ultimately, these platforms do hold so much power.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, thinking about, you know, kind of TikTok in the way that a lot of artists now, music artists, use TikTok to then kind of take that first step into their kind of own popularity, their career. And that's, you know, that's a reality. That's how the music industry has shifted. So it does feel a bit, you know, kind of incongruent to the fact that TikTok are very focused on music. I think they're, you know, in another world, they're a big partner with Eurovision and all of this. They promote new music. And like you say, that statement says about them bullying, you know, kind of in that respect. So it's interesting. I mean, all of this stuff as well happens behind kind of closed doors. So we don't know exactly what the kind of end game is really either. So yeah, I mean, I'm sure they will come back to the platform, but you just kind of hope it's done in a way where they both agree, you know, so it works for both parties. That's kind of, I think, is important.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think that what you don't want out of this, you don't want Universal to have to go, we have no choice, let's go with the lesser deal that TikTok offered us, and they're not going to do any of the things we've asked them to do. You want TikTok to kind of be able to address these problems the way that, according to Universal, the way their other partners are doing. And it'll be interesting to see what happens there. But I think also a point you just raised, Jonathan, was, you know, there are certain partners, it's a bit of a chicken egg situation. There are certain artists who were discovered on TikTok and their own music is now owned by Universal and they've had their channels muted. And they're like, well, thanks to TikTok, Universal have got me in the first place. So, and now you're making me get muted. And there's so many different facets to this. It's going to be fascinating how it plays out.
Yeah, on that point, it's actually quite interesting because they do sort of have like a symbiotic relationship wherein the fact that both of them need each other. I mean, I looked into Universal, they have massive artists. They have Taylor Swift, Drake, they have Coldplay. The list sort of goes on. They have Critty Crylish or Billie Eilish, just Kieran likes to say. Kieran,
it was a itty bitty Crylish or something he called it yesterday.
Something like that, yeah. So, you know, they have massive, massive artists. So it's quite sad actually that this is not really working out. But that kind of leads into my next question and what you touched on, Lindsay, which is, are publishers being held to ransom by platforms over their reach?
As the publisher. Well, yeah, you're a publisher too, but as a publisher.
Yeah, as a publisher. Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, this question's kind of, you know, when you think about the kind of the different approaches you have to social media channels and the way that we as a publisher will use social media, because it's absolutely imperative that we have content, which is, you know, we kind of create content that works for the best way for our audiences, right, and all of that. So when things like this happen, I think for us, because, you know, TikTok's a really important channel, but it's all out of our control. And that's the concern, you know, that kind of, we don't know exactly what decisions TikTok are making, because TikTok are often, and, you know, it can apply to all social media channels, but they're thinking about themselves, their distribution, their audience, and what's best for their business. But obviously their business is made up of lots of publishers who are creating content. So, you know, it's kind of, it will always kind of go around in a little bit of a circle there. But I do think that element of just, you know, publishers don't have the kind of access to these kind of decisions and why they're being made, which can, you know, create a challenge. Like I say, specifically around things like content licensing, that's where, especially when using platforms, all of this, that can be a real challenge.
Right. Interesting stuff. I'm going to move us on to our next story, which is still on the thread of social media. This story comes from Social Media Today, and that is, a new report looks at evolving social media usage trends. YouTube remains the online video leader, according to a consumer study by Pew Research. YouTube is the platform that most people spend time on regularly, being used by 83% of US adult respondents, versus Facebook, which is at 68%, Instagram, which is at 47%, and TikTok, which is at 33%. So Lindsay, going to you here first. How can publishers harness social platforms to their advantage?
I think that the way that that research shook out, showing kind of what the most popular platforms are, and also it kind of gives you an idea of kind of what the most popular format consumptions is, are, because consumption is, and also kind of what the demographic looks like for each one. And it's interesting to see kind of the burgeoning use of TikTok, et cetera. And we're seeing more publishers use TikTok. We're seeing, you know, your traditional news publishers actually create TikTok accounts and try to kind of present the news. We're seeing like, there's this world where a journalist or a newsreader kind of has a personality again, and people are actually seeking that person out for decades. Really, it used to be, I'll go and read this person's column on whatever newspaper I read it on. That disappeared, and the name and the voice and the style behind it kind of went away. I think it's even more important, especially with AI like taking over, it's even more important that publishers are able to bring those voices and those styles back and kind of be able to see what platforms are out there. They can't just rely on their own distribution, like owned distribution channels anymore. They have to take advantage of go where the people are and communicate with them in the way that they are used to being communicated with. And the rise of TikTok shows that. And the rise of short form video consumption shows that. And I think if publishers kind of just like bury their head in the sand and don't react to that, they're probably going to like fall down. But right. We are beholden, a publisher, even B2B publishers like ExchangeWire, we're beholden to the platforms. We've just highlighted how much power these platforms have. We're very much beholden to them. You know, use the wrong piece of music in a TikTok or something, then it could get removed the next day. You know, you're using it to advertise. Imagine if you're an advertiser and you use a Taylor Swift ad, and then you go to your account manager at TikTok and you go, well, I can't use that anymore. And they go, sorry, not our problem. It's our deal with Universal. You'll have to do it again. And that's the cost to the advertiser. I know I'm backtracking on the previous story, but there's a lot of things you have to think about when we are actually kind of doing anything on social media. And we are beholden to any kind of algorithm changes that mean that we're really visible on day one. And then for whatever reason, our content's completely disappeared on day two. And there's a lot of things you have to think about and keep abreast of the whole time. And it becomes very challenging.
Right. Jonathan, what are your thoughts on that?
So, I mean, actually, you know, in terms of what Deserto does, because we're a gaming content and entertainment content publisher, we have to be really close to these platforms. So, you know, if you look at the gaming space, a lot of creators, they're across platforms like Twitch and all of this. But so, you know, we have to be really, you know, focused on the changes in platforms and consumption and audience and all that great stuff. What I would say, actually, is I wasn't surprised that YouTube was kind of top. I mean, there's various, you know, kind of businesses I've worked across and being involved, you've always seen YouTube as a very consistent kind of platform. But actually where I think YouTube, I wouldn't say, is it a win or lose situation? But it's great because it's video content. And exactly to that point of like, kind of, you know, people go to YouTube because they love the creators, they love the talent. Video content lives there really, really well. But also it's got this, YouTube has got an appeal right the way across all ages. So, you know, YouTube is appealing because you've got, like I say, a younger audience going there. You've got YouTube Shorts as well. So I think they've done a good job in pulling it together. And then I was just thinking about kind of YouTube in terms of, you know, people that were born from YouTube. So a really good one in the UK is The Sidemen. I mean, they've got just over 20 million sort of followers now.
Yeah,
and they're building out, you know, and their brand's gone nuts and all this. So I'm not sort of surprised that YouTube still holds that almost kind of that you know, the penetration in terms of audience. It's doing a really good job. What I would say, thinking about it, is that I think the social media almost platforms they're all starting to do a job in themselves. They're competing, but you know, you go to Insta for a certain thing, you know, like you go to, X and Twitter obviously has been in the news a lot. We find we get a lot of interaction on there because a gaming audience does actually like to be on the platform. And as long as you keep your content wholesome, you're okay. But I think we are now finding that kind of different social platforms are really good at what they do. And they are, I don't want to say they're staying in their lanes, but actually you've got some good choice. And I think that's a positive really, because, you know, you go to TikTok because you want your short form video, works brilliantly well. YouTube, longer form content, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, I think there's a positive there in the way that social media platforms are kind of developing.
Right. I want to stay with you on the second question here, Jonathan, as our resident publisher guest. How is the landscape evolving from your point of view?
I mean, it's partly to that. It's evolving in the you know, keeping close to the platforms in what works really well. That's, as a publisher, that's what we do. So, you know, if we're creating some content which we know is going to be short form, but it needs to be really punchy, and it might be talking about, I'll just use a real world example with Deserto, it might be talking about kind of a new game release. If we're doing a really short kind of, this is what it is, this is how you can play it, this is why it's really great, TikTok is absolutely perfect for that. If we're doing kind of longer form, this is what shorts, you know, it could be a longer form piece, which is a bit more documentary style, whatever it is, then YouTube is a great sort of place for that. So for us, it's about having the resource to always be looking at the latest trends and then kind of building out the right content so it lands.
Right. It's interesting, isn't it? Because each sort of have their own unique audience demographic. And from that, you can sort of like diversify content strategy, which I'd imagine to be the case.
Yeah, we're still, I think generally, I'm going to say publishers in the really broad sort of scope here. We're still a little bit guilty sometimes of pushing content onto social. Like, we've put it on the site, let's put it on social. And actually social needs its own strategy. You've got to be creating content, which is, you know, kind of unique to the platform. I was also looking into it in terms of just developments and things. And it's like, you know, when Threads launched, and of course it was right in the middle of when everyone was very, very anti, you know, the Twitter to X move. And again, they're talking about actually making, it's all part of Meta, of course, but, you know, making it much more open, you know, so we'll actually interact with other platforms, making it much more kind of open web and all of that. So I think it'd be interesting to see where that goes. I think also with Meta, if you look at what they're doing, whilst Facebook is still, you know, one of the biggest platforms, people use it for different reasons, etc., but they do have the tech side as well. They're talking a lot about Meta Quest 3 at the moment, that kind of mixed reality, and how does it all sink into that? So that's where Meta, I think, have a, you know, they'll be talking about both the tech and the platforms as well. So
definitely. Lindsay, what are your thoughts on that? How is the landscape evolving from your point of view?
I think that when you talk to brands, agencies and publishers, you get the sense that there is, we've shifted from all these different names we talked about YouTube, TikTok, even Pinterest. I forgot about Pinterest.
Yeah, but cool.
Pinterest,
you must forget about Pinterest. Been doing a brilliant job, actually.
Really, really brilliant job. And they're still maintaining a decent market share, and they are kind of quite a powerful player in sort of the shoppability perspective and the retail perspective. You know, Instagram plays a role in that, but Pinterest plays a separate role, and actually they are really, really strong in that area. But I think that what you also start to see is that some of these channels are being referred to less as social. Like, it's no longer like, oh, let's invest in social. And while obviously it's still very much social, like putting money in social, where it sits on a media plan, I think social media is not like a line item on a media plan. And you've got social teams that aren't exclusively doing social. YouTube has always been a bit of a funny one in terms of where it sits within an agency group, for example, who manages it, who plans it. It could be bought by anybody. And it's starting to be talked about in TV conversations, not in social conversations. And I think that, you know, TikTok, despite being a very, very short form video format, that could also then start seeing more blurred lines. Like, if YouTube's being talked about in a TV context, could TikTok get there as well, as people, certainly for the younger generation that aren't really consuming TV, and I'm using air quotes here, TV as we would be, as older folk would define it, on a TV screen, they're viewing it on their phone. For the next generation, the cord cutters and the cord nevers, it doesn't matter where these things are being viewed. So actually, is TikTok a social platform? Is YouTube a social platform in the way that TikTok is? Like, do people use YouTube the way they would consider kind of conversing, communicating and building community? I don't think that that's the case. I think it probably in that respect does fit more into a TV landscape and TV conversation than it does into a social conversation. So I think that the lines are becoming really blurred, and that makes it interesting from a kind of like, where does my media go, and from a planning and buying perspective as well.
Definitely. So I'm going to take us to our final story of today, and that comes from FT. Amazon strikes ad data deal with Reach as Google kills off cookies. So Amazon has struck a deal with Reach, which is the UK's largest publisher, to obtain customer data for targeted online advertising. The partnership is designed to compensate for the loss of third-party cookies. Reach will share its contextual first-party data, and Amazon will use this information to sell more targeted ads on the publisher's sites. So Jonathan, can publishers find themselves in a position of strength with tie-ups like this? What do you think?
So, I mean, again, I think there's a really good headline here. So thinking about it broadly, it's the idea that obviously with everything happening with cookie depreciation, again, we can always talk about that for hours and where that sort of sits. I think it's a headline. You know, Reach have actually, you know, working with Amazon. Again, we don't know the nature of the deal. We don't know what the increment to revenue will be to Reach. All of that kind of, you know, I'm sure has obviously been discussed, and I'm sure there are positives there. But it is the idea of contextual data being so important. Of course, this is where publishers like, hooray, you know, that's what we have in abundance. We're, you know, high quality premium publishers. So the fact that Reach have, you know, struck this deal, I think is a really good headline for publishers, in that as we're moving forward, this could be the way. I I think in terms of things like exclusivity and all of this, I mean, obviously this is going to give Amazon some really, because Reach have, you know, lots of titles within their portfolio, news titles, magazines, all of that. So it's going to give them some really good contextual kind of, you know, indicators they'll be able to take to clients and all of that. So I think there's positives there. Whether this is the revolution and you know, and I certainly don't think deals like this will be exclusive, because publishers will always want lots of solutions in order to be able to ensure that, you know, kind of advertisers are getting the best from them, basically. But yeah, I think just as a broad thing, I think it's really positive. I mean, eyes on Google at the moment. I mean, even in the UK now, the you know, the kind of Competition and Markets Authority are saying, you know, hang on, this looks like it might be anti-competitive, depreciating the cookie. So, and I think if that happens, naturally, publishers, unfortunately, will go, oh, we've got more time. So deals like this won't, you know, it's great that the bigger publishers or bigger groups like Reach can do it. So, you know, I still think, and I know you hear this all the time, the deadlines that we're talking about at the moment, it's accelerated it, but I still think we've got a way to go. So I think that, you know, it's not going to happen. And also, of course, Sandbox with Google at the moment, there's a lot of conversation, shall we say, around that not being the solution that maybe we thought it would be. So, yeah.
Right, I feel like we'd have a whole new podcast episode just on third-party cookies and all the issues that are going on with that.
Easily.
But Lindsay, what are your thoughts on that? Can publishers find themselves in a position of strength?
I think that they can. I feel like, I mean, so there are some really good examples, and I think the Amazon Reach deal being an FT headline is just because Amazon's such a big, in this context, a brand. It's being referred to as a tech giant, but in this context, it's a brand giving, like, getting their data from a publisher to be able to target people on that publisher's suite of sites better. Is effectively what it is. We're seeing that lots, and we're seeing there's plenty of big publishers out there in the UK. I'm thinking of Shortlist, of Telegraph, or two that spring to mind. That Shortlist, Silas Group, used to be Shortlist, that have, you know, been trying to get rid of the cookie for ages, and they've been trying to kind of work on these direct deals for a long, long time. So there's lots of opportunity for that, for publishers to kind of, I guess, take back control, is what you'd say. Some publishers might argue, well, we never lost control, so, like, give us a break, guys. Come on. But there's lots of opportunities there. But also, I'm confused by the whole cookie conversation, because, you know, you've got the CMA coming out and saying this is anti-competitive. Yes, I don't disagree with that, because this only really serves to benefit Google. Like, when Apple did it, it only really served to benefit Apple. It doesn't serve anybody else except Apple themselves. But the CMA didn't like butt in then. I guess because Google's obviously much bigger in terms of its browser volume of users. But I think that we'd all agreed a while ago, yes, the cookie isn't fit for purpose. The third party cookie doesn't do the job we want it to do. We kind of took it and ran with it, and it's like a hack upon a hack upon a hack that we've kind of got this situation we're into. Actually, this is no bad thing. Let's use this as an opportunity to create something new and build new ideas and build new ways of working and kind of go back to what programmatic and RTB used to be. There's no denying that what Google's doing is fundamentally changing RTB. There's no denying that at all. And, you know, the IRB Tech Lab come out and said that the Privacy Sandbox is not fit for purpose. I don't disagree with that. I don't think it was ever going to be. It was never supposed to replace a third-party cookie. Funny enough, we've got a webcast with IRB Tech Lab ourselves on the 13th of February. You can sign up on exchangeworld.com, where we'll be kind of discussing this with them. So Kieran will be getting a conversation with The Telegraph and Scott Messer from his own publishing consultancy in the US, and Shaylee and Hillary from IRB Tech Lab to discuss the ins and outs of their findings, which I think will be very interesting, because I'm just a bit like, hang on. Why are we all complaining about this when we all kind of collectively agreed? And Jonathan, you made a great point. Like, if the deadlines push back further, all everyone will do is just go, oh, great, I will just sit back and just kind of like give myself more time. We need a deadline to be able to kind of make these changes. And I feel like the changes, I don't love that it's been run by Google, but honestly, who else are going to be controlled by?
Right.
Who else is going to be able to make that decision and have that kind of impact on the industry? Like, a publisher couldn't do it. It has to be somebody like Google. We have to make these changes. And I think that there's just I'm sensing a lot of kind of depression, misery from publishers at the moment, especially in the US, especially. It feels like there's a lot of like, oh, this is so bad. It's the end of the world. And kind of like we're completely screwed over. And while I don't disagree with that, you do hear from some other publishers that go, this is good for us. We need this.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, going back to that point, I think the first thing when I went with this story was, this is a real headline in all of this, because there's so much conversation around it, but none of it ever really feels like there's kind of a significant step forward. And exactly as you say, and I totally agree, we know the cookie is going to go, and, yeah, you know, that's going to happen, and we agree it's the right thing to do. So yeah, with this, I think great to see. And it has to be people with scale. I think that's the thing. The first movers have to be. And yes, there are arguments behind it. It's like, you know, kind of Google own it. And now Amazon have with their kind of scale and what they're doing. So it's always going to be these big players. So, you know, we've got to kind of keep an eye on that, of course. But it's like I say, very simply, it's a positive step forward because it's hitting the headlines. And I think a lot of people will be watching it as well, you know, across the industry and sort of thinking, right, has that worked? What does that mean? What can we do and be part of that? So yeah, it's yeah, like I say, I'm gonna do the whole content is king as a publisher. So yes, let's lean into that as well as all the stuff we know about our audience.
So Jonathan, do you think that Amazon is actually creating a CTV walled garden for itself through this? What are your thoughts on that?
I don't know as they're creating, I don't know whether the motivation for them is to say, right, we want a walled, you know, a specific walled garden for this. And it's kind of, no one else can have access and all of those things. But I think they probably, it's more about, I don't want to keep saying about it being the headline, but I think that that's actually why this is an important deal, because it could have all been done a little bit, not only behind closed doors, but it could be a very soft launch of it and let's see how it works and all of this, but actually making a reasonable deal out of it. So I think it's just putting that stake in the ground to say that as this happens, we are a really, you know, good option to look at how we can work with contextual data. So I think it's more that. I don't know whether there's a, you know, specific kind of drive to it being kind of creating that. I mean, it may do, but yeah, I think more it's more about being a player in that space and making sure that's known.
Lindsay, what are your thoughts on that?
I think I agree with Jonathan on that. I think that there's more to it at play than just kind of looking at it from a CTV context. I do think it's just, to me, it just feels like any kind of other brand publisher direct partnership, which is, you know, how display used to be managed, and we're going back to the old school ways. And I think it's just because it's such a big company we're talking about that does have so many different aspects to it. Amazon, you know, covers a broad church of things. And Reach is a huge publisher with loads of different, like hundreds of like local sites. Admittedly, not many of them are very like, have interesting advertising choices, but that's, you know, a different conversation entirely. But I think that it's going to be a big partnership. But I think Reach are also trying to probably converse with a bunch of other brands in the context of what Amazon's doing here to create similar partnerships for them to be able to go, this is our data. This is how you can speak to our audience, and that is going to be really powerful. That and things like curation, which is, you know, bringing everything together, bringing the first and third party data together. There's lots of opportunities here. I feel like I'm being a positive person about what's going to come up, but I think that there's an opportunity for publishers. I mean, are you a Deserto miserable?
Yeah, I mean, as I say, going to say I'm miserable. I was going to say I'm genuinely a positive person. No, we're not. We're always positive. I think actually it's just being where the right solutions are, okay? So you work with multiple DSPs, you're looking at different solutions for ID, like LiveRamp, et cetera. You're always thinking about what is the best solution. And ultimately, you know, as a business, we're a commercial business, we're driven by our clients, by working with the kind of media agencies. So, you know, you're taking all of that into account and then optimizing it. And for us as well, we have to, this is just looking at Deserto, but, you know, when you've got a gaming audience, we have to be, you know, in terms of the ads they're served, all of that, we have to be very, very conscious of that too. So it's all that going in. But actually, no, I would say, yeah, no, generally actually pretty positive because more solutions are coming through, you know, and we're on point to kind of work and make sure that they're optimized for us. So yeah.
Definitely. It'll be interesting to see how this one plays out. And on that positive note, that is all the time that we have for this week's Mad Tech podcast episode. Jonathan, thank you so much for taking the time to be here today.
No problem at all. It's a pleasure to be here.
Lindsay, a pleasure as always.
Oh, absolutely. I've really enjoyed this discussion. It's been great.
And that's it for this week's Mad Tech podcast.